Hi guys, it's Josh here from the Crane of Command podcast. Thank you very much again for downloading this episode and listening today as we have another interesting interview with another interesting individual. Another person out there making videos on YouTube talking about sort of old hammer content, but a bit of new hammer. It's a bit of a blend of the both, which is nice. Looking at like alternative miniature companies and things like that. So for sort of miniature agnostic games that Stompy enjoys playing with his friends and colleagues where he lives in the UK. So it's always interesting. I'd like the way he presents the videos and talks about them and that kind of thing. So that's why I asked Stompy on to say, let's talk about it. Let's talk about your history. Let's talk about how you got into this wonderful world of tabletop miniature gaming. So I hope you look forward to that in just a little while. In other news, I have a whole stream of guests. I'm really trying to get as many people and trying to keep the podcast on a weekly basis now, if I can, and or every 2 weeks or so. But at the moment, it's going pretty well. So as long as I've got the guests coming on and wanting to come and speak with us, then the podcast will be more of a regular basis, which is great. And so I had a extensive chat with Adrian Wood, a former longtime employee of Games Workshop, 25 years in fact. So Adrian's seen it all from the game inside the Games Workshop's dark veil or the Iron Curtain. He knows everybody. Well, a great deal of people within that company. And we had a great chat, very wonderful guy to talk to, very open about everything. First, he was very reluctant to come onto the podcast, but later he changed his mind and reached out to me and said, I really want to come and have a chat with you. So I'm really glad he did because he felt really good about it, which is lovely. And we both have a love of Epic Space Marine, the second edition version of Epic Space Marine. So it was really good to chat about that. And I'm going to bring him back on a live stream at some stage so you guys can interact with him directly and talk about all those classic articles and White Dwarf and battle reports that he partook in with other members of the studio staff. So that'll be really fun to look forward to and more details about that in the future. So that podcast will be the next one coming out after our chat with Stompy. So I'm sure you guys are looking forward to that. And after that, it's going to be a bit of Man of War with me, Chris, and Cameron, talking about particular fleets and races that we like to play in Man of War, as it is March Man of War month, but really we haven't really delved into a lot of Man of War stuff apart from the Kraken Wakes video that I shared in the last little mini-sode that Cameron talked about Manowar and how to get into it. And I hope you enjoyed that. In other news, there is you can listen to the Adrian Woods interview if you are a Patreon of mine. It's now up there on early access, and there will be also a Patreon exclusive because it was like almost like a 3-hour conversation. So the first hour I've cut and edited up as an early access before next week. And then there'll be another almost 2-hour length sort of in the middle of that conversation, basically covering more personal stuff or sort of, the nitty gritties of working for big corporations like Games Workshop. So I hope that's going to be really interesting for people who can access that in the future. And also, speaking of the P word, Patreon, I did upload my very first painting video, which centers on the Orc Evil Sun's knob and just painting green skin, like the actual skin tone. So just focusing directly on his face and painting and completing that face. And that'll be like a stage by stage. Each week, I'll upload a new video The next one covering like his power claw and like his chest plate in red, and the next part maybe looking at some freehand, the next part looking at maybe doing non-metallic metals, and each week we'll have a sort of a, 20 minute, 25 minute video. They're much more in detail than the videos on my YouTube channel, so it's basically just me talking through the process and giving you tips and hints and that kind of thing along the way. So I hope that becomes very successful, and it also becomes a very useful and practical tutorial series with the Evil Ed Masterclass underway now. So I'm really excited about that. I'm really glad it's out and it's started, and it gives me it gave me a much better way of delivering those videos rather than trying to paint an entire miniature in one session. It just wasn't practical for me to do that. So hope you can join us there at Patreon and check that out if you are interested in painting. If you're not, then you can access all the other exclusives, or sort of before they come out, kind of early access videos or audio on there as well, and support the channel. Anyhow, guys, I'm going to leave you to it with Stompy 51 and his story about how he got into this wonderful world of wargaming. Thanks very much for listening. Take care and see you on the other side. And so, Stompy, thanks very much for coming to join us.
I am excited to be part of your kind of wider social network, because one thing I've learned, you bring together so many different people from so many different facets of the hobby. You know, the old hammer kind of Nottingham greats to, random nobodies like me who are, on their path to becoming Mr. Beast in their mind's eye. And so I'm excited to be here.
Mate, I stumbled across your content. I don't know how, but somewhere on YouTube it sort of popped up maybe, and I just saw the Stompy 51 and something like a tagline with old hammer or something. So I started clicking on that, checking it out, and then realizing, wow, you do some really nice stuff. You covered some Golden Demon 1990, 1991, I think, books of the time, which were fantastic, and some codexes or army books or what have you. And you've got a wonderful collection of miniatures from your attic or garage that you pull out and bring out and showcase on the channel. And it's just nice listening to you talk about the history of the miniatures or the projects you're working on.
Well, I mean, that's very kind of you to say. I mean, the old hammer content that I generate does tend to be wildly more popular than everything else. But the thing is, I wouldn't describe myself as an old hammer channel. I call it, as a laugh, a Stompy 51 miniature adventure. We can talk about why I call myself Stompy 51, silly name as it is. But the reality is, it's each of us has our own personal journey in this hobby. And I've had my own distinct kind of journey, and I just thought to myself, some of it can be a lonely journey because there's different facets to the hobby. You've got assembly, modeling, you've got painting, you've got playing and gaming, you've got lore. But the thing is, only some of that involves other people. And I thought, I've had my own journey. I've loved watching the journeys of other people. Obscurities in miniature, was one guy, Scruffy Crows, another guy, Johnny Watson Gaming. And I thought to myself, why don't I share my own little journey? Some of it is old hammer because that reflects my age, the geography of where I've been. But the thing is, a lot of it just reflects great miniatures I've had. And in many ways, my channel is almost a response to the downsides of Games Workshop. Games Workshop has given us all so much. I would never kick it. But equally, by the same token, as I've seen now, has been kind of backed up by a number of people who have left, that their business model is, we need to go big. We don't get out of bed for less than whatever it is, 10 grand for a particular product. We're not interested in the grognards, cognards, whatever we're called, because basically, we have an 18 to 24 month cycle. We need to grab as much as we can from whatever the young demographic is. They're only going to be in the hobby for so long, and then we just replace all the books, update all the miniatures. And I found myself thinking, why I'm not a whale. I'm not designed to be sucked in someone else's business model. I've got a garage full of lovely miniatures, and just because they're kind of intellectual property of some particular company, which has its own, impetus, its own imperative to kind of constantly keeping everyone buying new stuff. Why do I need to do that? There's been this explosion of miniature agnostic games, you know, and I do know people who are happy to play them. And so why, you know, for me, the fun thing is just taking these miniatures and kind of going counter culture, going counter to what all these companies expect, and just using what you want, when you want, with the people that you want to play with. And, you know, if I can hit bash something, you know, which is a piece of old hammer, a piece of current GW plastic, a piece of something 3D printed, you know, and then my very, very limited green stuffing skills, and I can make that a distinct, unique thing, which I find fun, well, and then get it on the table painted, you know, to play someone in some game system that, though created by some random guy, is much more fun and much more interesting than any Games Workshop game. Well, for me, that's part of my little Stompy 51 miniature adventure. I thought, why not share that? And so I would say probably a good proportion of the videos are just random stuff like that, you know, from random bits of collection. Some of it I do open new stuff and I do a bit of unboxing. Some of it is, you know, for me, when I'm stuck out and about on my travels, you know, I can then look at the videos of all these books that I've recorded, and people come back with feedback, you know, feedback on my miniatures. It's often positive and warm and lovely, but sometimes it's like, mate, you have no understanding of the color wheel, do you? You know, you painted that guy in an orange jumpsuit with a kind of a flesh, you know, a skeleton kind of head, and there's no spot color, and this thing is just meh. And I think, do you know what? I've learned something.
It's good, mate. I'm really glad you because I think it's a brave step for people to expose themselves on YouTube. It's a massive platform. There could be, you know, hundreds of thousands of views. So, you know, I think it's a big step for anybody to merge out of their own little hobby space and then make it public. You know, record it, show people what you've got, especially painting, because I know painting is very, very much a personal thing, and people are just like, oh, I don't know if I want to show my stuff because I don't know what reaction I'll get from people. I don't think that's really a case that people should be concerned about. I think just doing it, making the content, making something original, making something for yourself. And like you said, it's like a miniature adventure. It's kind of like it's a video blog of your hobby history or the projects you're working on. And for me personally, I think it's just really interesting to see what you're up to, even if it's not old hammer centric. It's kind of just, you know, interesting for me to have playing in the background and watching what you're tinkering with on your hobby desk and what you've been painting that week or that month or what have you. So, yeah, no, thanks, mate, for making it. And I think hopefully after this podcast, people will be more attracted to come and see what you're doing on your YouTube channel and check out your content there. So let's go back in time.
First of all, let's pause for a moment and just highlight that point. So anyone who is, you know, listening to this, the first thing you need to do is just stop this, go onto YouTube and subscribe to my channel, and then come back. Because, you know, as I discussed at the beginning of this, I'm looking really ultimately to give Mr. Beast, you know, and, you know, Sniper Wolf a run for their money. You know, if they can have, like, you know, more viewers than, like, some countries in the world, I don't see why my little hobby channel can't do the same. So that's what people should stop doing. The thing I would say, though, is, you know, we're very lucky in the hobby community. You know, people are much warmer than in most parts of the internet, you know, particularly with the politics going on these days. We're not going to talk about any of it, but I've been beyond horrified at how polarized and how nasty people are to each other online. Yeah. I remember listening to this one history podcast, and they were talking about, I think, the American Civil War, the English Civil War, and they were talking about how, you know, in like a kind of 50-year horizon, for whatever ridiculous ideological conflict, people stopped saying, you know, I'm an American, you're an American, we disagree. It was like, I'm an American, and you're the spawn of Satan. And the same thing with the English Civil War, you know, I'm English, you're not English, you know, actually, you're some different religion to me, you know, effectively, and you're the spawn of Satan. And then after 50 years of this kind of horrible fighting, there was a civil war. And so there's like this long pause as everyone looks at the historian and says, don't you think we're at that point now, you know, in the kind of 50-year kind of, you know, trajectory? And the historian kind of pauses because he just realizes what he said. And then he's like, yeah. So in the wargaming community, we're nowhere near that. We're nowhere near that. Although, you know, is that guy Jerry on Tabletop?
Oh, Jerry.
Talking about like slaying people for like using square bases instead of round ones. But other than the round and square base kind of, you know, division in the hobby.
Yeah.
which is often the most controversial part of any new kind of miniature agnostic game. Yeah. I think we're a lovely bunch. And people are really kind of supportive. And the other funny thing that I was listening to the other day is a mate of mine is in, I won't say the word because we'll kind of, you know, get picked up by the wrong people. But, you know, there are bad guys in the world who want to do many bad things. And he's part of the security services who kind of track them online and try to track them down.
Right.
And he was talking about following the finances of it. And he was explaining how some of it's impossible to follow because there's something called Huala, whereby, you know, I don't know if you've heard of this. If you have, well done. You know, I only just heard of it. Basically, you have one guy in one part of the world, and you say to him, I'll give you $1,000, and can you call your mate in this other country and tell him to give my mate over there $1,000? And those two guys trust each other enough to just go, okay. So nothing has been tracked. Nothing has gone on any system, and that's impossible to follow. It's called Huala. And I remember thinking the gaming community is so close that if you go to, like, you know, Oldhammer Facebook trading groups, you know, I'm happy to post something to a guy in the States off the back of him having pictures of, you know, Felix and Gottschalk from 1992. Because my assumption is if he's shown me a couple of pictures of them, you know, in different positions that he's got them, and someone who has Felix and Gottschalk isn't going to screw me over. And so, you know, in terms of opening yourself up to the community, you know, this is one of the most unjudgmental communities out there.
Yeah.
And we basically got our own kind of Huala system going on Facebook swaps. The other thing I would say, though, in terms of kind of painting and painting kind of quality, I mean, listen, I'm not you. My painting is great. I like to think of it as kind of tabletop plus. But the thing is, so many people have like this mind block about painting because of the concern that they have. They think that you have to be Golden Demon or, you know, what was called in the White Dwarf magazines, heavy metal. You know, you don't need to be heavy metal. You know, I'm intensely relaxed about playing whole games with just an undercoated army, undercoated gray. Because the view I take is, this is a hobby. It's our hobby. You do what you want. And no one paints chess pieces. People have played chess their entire lives and never thought they can't play because one side's black and one side's white. You know, I played an amazing game of Kings of War with my mega Oldhammer dwarf army, which I've been collecting from various manufacturers for at least 20 years, and none of it is painted. And I've played three games of Kings of War with it. I mean, obviously it's been helpful that I've won every single game, but mostly because I have a lot of bombards, which is naughty. But basically, it's been great fun. The opponent hasn't complained. His army's painted, mine's not. And so, you know, I say to people, don't hold back, just give it a go. People contact me, you know, and say, there was one guy, lovely guy, Ethnarch, I think he comments on your stuff. He's a Finnish guy, lovely guy. We've been exchanging messages, you know, because part of the fun of my channel is, you know, when you're sitting in a bus stop on a train for work or whatever, you know, you can just look at comments and write something back and you've done something fun and hobby related in what was otherwise a dead period.
Yeah.
And he was saying to me like, oh yeah, no, I haven't played a game because I'm waiting till I get to 1,000 points painted of Oldhammer to go to this local group in Finland to play. And I was like, mate, just get on with it. No one there is going to complain. You know, otherwise, you know, you'll hit a certain age and you'll think, gee, you know, I haven't done something because I was worried what people would think. In this hobby, no one is worried. Anyway, after your Swedish lovelies the other day, you said you never got a word in edgeway, so I'm going to now sit quiet.
Good old Krell. Yeah, they were a classic bunch. I'm sure I'm going to throw in a little bit of a promo about this in this case it was Friday White Live. Usually it's a Saturday White Live or a Sunday White Live, but the boys from Sweden, Krell and Jimmy, joined me on a Friday because they took the day off because of Final Fantasy VII of all things. So if you haven't checked it out, go to my YouTube channel and check it out. After you subscribe to Stompy51's channel, then go and check out the Saturday Sunday Night White Lives because they're quite fun.
They were fantastic because again, one thing that you really do with all these amazing podcasts is you give like flavor and color to how different people have approached the hobby from different angles. And for me, over the years, you know, listening to a bunch of Aussies talking about Blood Bowl or a bunch of Americans in the Midwest talking about, you know, how they were, you know, about to go to some massive convention, but then some kind of hurricane kind of went through Hurricane Alley, which is where they live. And, you know, all these things give kind of local color. So hearing how, you know, there were Swedes going down to like some kind of local marketplace, talking to a Swedish Rastafarian to try and get some Oldhammer Marines at sort of some kind of discount and the haggling. Yeah, that was great fun.
Yeah. I love that. Oh, mate. Yeah, Krell's the best. He and Jimmy too. They're just wonderful guys. And interestingly too, you before when you were talking about Games Workshop and sort of attracted to the younger demographic, is that really the case? Because I just saw like photos of people lining up to get the old world new rule books, and it's all gray, mate, or no hair at all. So I just think, you know, compared to the 90s, where they're not targeting young kids anymore, it's kind of like the, you know, late 30s, early 40s demographic. Would that be the case, do you think?
So look, neither of us are currently sitting in their boardrooms, but there's one podcast called The Painting Phase, and they seem to have, because they are younger than us, I think, and
Yeah.
they seem to have contact with people who have recently left Games Workshop. And one guy who I think was from their whichever department kind of designed paints and knives and whatever, he said we had some kind of internal principle, which was, if it's not, we don't get out of bed for anything less than 10K. If there are some people who, have some kind of interesting idea which could, be attractive to kind of old hammer guys, that's good for them. They can pay off their mortgage with it. But as far as we're concerned, that's small beer. We need something that's worth a company of our size doing it. And so I think, and I'm surmising here, that this whole old Warhammer, the old world thing, is the exception that proves the rule. I think their internal kind of commercial ideology is, look, the real money is in happy to spend 100 quid or whatever on a computer game. We get them to buy a 100 quid box set, they're in out. Forget about people like me, who are interested in 15, 20 different miniature companies and have all the miniatures they need till the day they die. I need to get realistic at some point. I'm never going to paint everything I have at the rate I'm painting, but I still like having it. So I think I think it must be when they saw the success of Kings of War, and they thought, do you know what? That might tick the box of being whatever sum we need to make a business case, for return on investment to get out of bed on this project. And I think that might be why, they've already run out of stock because, they budgeted for X amount of stock, it's sold, and they just don't think it's worth redoing it. Or either that, or they've got some kind of massive logistics problem going on.
Okay, interesting. Interesting point of view about that. Yeah, because you know, for me, I mean, they're not targeting me. They're targeting, I think, the generation before me. I think they're targeting the sort of the Lord of the Rings crowd, personally. You
Aren't
know,
they all German?
I
Who says
don't
Lord of the Rings here?
know, but this, it seems to be that kind of. There's two generations: this HeroQuest generation and the Lord of the Rings generation. I think the Lord of the Rings generation. And the people who wrote the rules are from the guys who wrote Lord of the Rings. So it all seems to fit into me in that,
Yeah,
you
no, that makes
know
sense.
what I mean? It's that sort of 35 to 45 kind of, you know, age gap where they're trying to capture those guys who got into 8th edition and that kind of thing.
So, but it's interesting. We were joking before about basing being the subject most likely to lead to a kind of gaming civil war. So the reason I haven't got into this game, other than the fact that there's about 50 gaming systems I've got that I haven't fully played out. Do I need a 51st gaming system? But I thought to myself, I've got an Empire army on 20 mil bases. There is no way I'm going to cut them up and put them on 30 mil bases. I've got orcs and goblins, not doing that. The only kind of totally unassembled army I have that's not either on 20 mil bases square or on Age of Sigmar basing is Skaven. And Skaven is like the one unsupported army for Warhammer the Old World. So I thought to myself, do you know what? I've reached this kind of crazy accumulation bit. Maybe I've never had Bretonians. Who doesn't like knights? I'll get some of those. So I ask my friendly local gaming store and I say, look, can you order these for me? And they go, they're only out of stock, kid. We'll order them when they get re when they get done. So and nothing has been forthcoming. So I haven't really got involved in Warhammer and the Old World. And I'm doing fine with Kings of War. My dwarves are fine for Kings of War, my Empire's fine for Kings of War. And obviously there's Dragon Rampant, which both of these are fantastic gaming systems for people like you and me. We've got youngish families. We have busy jobs. Or the other bugbear I have with some systems, particularly by Games Workshop, is, but there are others, they think that you've got nothing else to do in the world but to kind of be sucked into the micro world of their gaming system.
Yeah.
Now, you know, maybe I'm a person who's a bit of a grasshopper, and I absolutely am. But, you know, I'm not sure in this day and age if there are people who are wholly sucked into one gaming system. You know, you've got the Honest Wargamer. I love listening to his show sometimes. But, you know, they are absolutely immersed in that world. And I'd be interested in your view. What proportion of the gaming community is genuinely sucked into being a whale, you know, who's on a hook, being sucked into constant cycling Games Workshop purchases?
Very little. I think in our community, like in terms of modern Games Workshop stuff, it's almost zero. I mean, there's the mail that, like, you know, for now, currently there are people actively playing the old world, but it's more about the made to order section of this revived Warhammer. It's the classic models coming back. The people are more excited about that than the actual game itself. I think the game is kind of secondary. And I think,
how many of those Marauder
giants
do you think they'll sell? Because I think there's an absolute
thousands, frenzy online. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe. I don't know, but I'm really interested to see how much it's going to be worth, like how much it will cost the end dollar, because that is a hefty amount of lead. And I just hope and pray that people can afford it when it comes out. And
I'm gonna take a punt at 55 quid, because they actually have to sell it.
I reckon 150 quid, mate.
No.
Yeah, I reckon 150 quid. You can bank
on it. I've got one. If someone gives me 150 quid,
yeah.
You know, no, I mean, I can buy my kid a bike or something. I wouldn't sell it. And the joke is, I think this has been discussed on your channel before, but most of the old Hammer stuff I have, I didn't buy in the 80s or the 90s, because I never had the money then.
Right.
These things were bought in the 2010s, when these things were kind of just about affordable.
Yes.
You know, for reasonable amounts of money on eBay.
Yep.
You know, and so that's when most of my collection is from, because no one wanted an old Hammer Marauder Giant in 2012, strangely. And so I was going to put this question to you later, but I'll put it to you now. Do you regard yourself as a hipster, you know, by being interested in old Hammer? Because, you know, isn't that part of being the hipster, like in those Ladybird books? You know, it's people who find some kind of like esoteric interest that no one really kind of follows. And then they kind of pride themselves saying, well, I don't do the mainstream stuff. I collect like vinyl records of a certain era. So, you know, maybe the Marauder Giant is just going to target wargaming hipsters.
Maybe so. Yeah, I've always been attracted to games that were not so commercially successful or well known. Like Confrontation from Rackham, Infinity from Corvus Belli. So during those days, they were very underground games, very small companies making really nice products. And I've always been attracted to that kind of, you know, those games sort of simmering underneath the, you know, the popularity of gaming, if that makes sense. So
I think you've got to distinguish between companies with a system which was good, but they never knew how to run a business.
Yeah.
And they went bust.
Yeah, they went bust. Yeah. That's
versus, you know, companies where, you know, the gaming system wasn't that great, you know, and that's why it kind of went fut.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm always interested to see what the smaller company is doing, even more now, I think, because there's so many good companies out there making the most beautiful models, if not just the game itself, but beautiful artwork and that kind of thing. I'm more attracted to that than the sort of the mainstream type gaming companies and their games and miniatures. I think the smaller companies are just more interesting to me personally. So
there's a lot of innovation.
Yes.
Amongst these smaller companies, because if you're in a bigger company, and people listening who are in bigger companies, they know that, you know, it's quite hard to kind of just change thinking. You know, and there's all these articles that have been written around, like, I'm trying to remember, is it, there was one company that they were the big kind of, like, maybe it was Xerox or something. They did all the photocopying machines, and they knew that digital was coming. They knew that digital cameras were coming. But the thing is, it was so politically dodgy internally to kind of basically pioneer the end of your own company. And, you know, that they just didn't do anything. And then ultimately someone else picked up the idea and just kind of changed, the grass grew under their feet, changed the entire environment. And then they just went bust. They went to kind of being a nothing. And so I think that is one of the advantages of, you know, all these little companies who come up with their little ideas. And I mean, in many ways, a lot of the games that I play, like Xenos Rampant, Dragon Rampant, I'm going to embarrass myself because I'm so bad at names. Is it Daniel Mersey? You know, so he's come up with, you know, this amazing high level conceptual system where, you know, you don't need to have like exact points for exact, you know, IP protected kind of units. You just conceptually have 10 different kind of units. You can sex them up, you can sex them down. And you can use this kind of sandbox system for absolutely anything. And it kind of got changed to be also for Xenos Rampant, you know, which is kind of not just fantasy, but kind of everything from World War One to kind of, you know, Dune, if you want to play it. And there's so much kind of creativity in that, which I think bigger companies just don't risk. And so many of these Games Workshop systems, amazing that Games Workshop is, you know, you buy the book, and I used to buy it with trust, thinking if they charged me 30 quid for it, they must have thought this through. They must have made this a playable game that is now a stable game that, you know, I can keep going with for a few years. And instead, you know, you buy these games, you know, they're not that slick, that they're full of mistakes, they're not necessarily that fun. And then they have the cheek after like two years to say, oh, we're releasing another edition, and the 60 quid you spent on all these books, you can torch, you flush it down the loo, which is exactly what's happening with Age of Sigmar. You know, I find, you know, I play Age of Sigmar because there are other guys at the friendly local gaming store who do, and I've got gorgeous miniatures. And the game is just about all right. You know, it's not one of the best systems I've played. I bought a couple of newish rule books about a year ago, and I was just listening to the Honest Wargamer YouTube channel, and he was proudly explaining how, you know, there's new Skaven out because Skaven are going to be in the box set for the fourth edition of Age of Sigmar. And I was like, are you kidding?
Nice. Yeah. So I think miniature agnostic games are just gaining popularity these days, even though I'm not a big fan of miniature agnostic games. I like the company to give me the rule set. I like them to give me the miniatures. I like them, yeah, you know, to provide everything for me as one solid package. But I can see the advantages of having miniature agnostic games for someone like yourself or other people who have an enormous range of models. Things like what's the other one? Shadow Deep?
Range of Shadow Deep. I've never played that.
It looks like a really interesting system. I like the concept of it. And it's like you can bring all your old school, you know, D&D models and, you know, use those in games and, you know, make terrain and that kind of thing as a solo experience. I think that's a really cool idea. I've never got to play it though, but I think I like the concept of it.
Look, I absolutely don't want to kick Games Workshop on this score because, as you say, there are upsides and downsides to everything. And the downside of, you know, I would say even Xenos Rampant or of Dragon Rampant is, you know, they're not necessarily that crunchy as systems. And also, you know, it's sometimes quite hard to, you know, if you want to have the idea of a dwarf conceptually as, you know, rugged with heavy armor, but slow moving and high morale, you can do that through these kind of sandbox systems. But it doesn't quite feel like a dwarf. You know, it's kind of like when you watch Star Trek and they make gags around, you know, when that you know, they have that kind of artificial like 3D printer that kind of makes food, and they always make the joke like, oh, you know, this doesn't taste like real peanut butter, you know what I mean? There is a degree of that with these miniature agnostic systems. So they have their place, but equally, you know, having something where someone has carefully thought through the lore behind this and matched the exact, you know, points and system to the lore for that little creature, I mean, that is a fantastic thing in itself. The problem I have is that the grass grows under your feet every time you step onto one of these systems. You know, by the time I bought it, I played two games, yeah, you know, because time moves slowly for me, you know, because I actually have a job and a family. And then, yeah, suddenly there's another edition, and then, you know, there's another layout. Or, yeah, the most insulting thing, they expect you to rebase, which, as we've described, is just a great way to start a riot in our community.
Yeah, please do not rebase your miniatures. That's the only thing I'll say to people. Don't rebase them. It's always better. It's always easier to go up than rather going back. You know, when you go up, you can't go back. So you can increase the base length, you know, anyhow, it's up to people's personal preferences. But look,
I've sterilized my Orc and Goblin 7th edition army because I rebased it for Age of Sigmar. And then they removed Orcs and Goblins, you know, from Age of Sigmar. I've abandoned it. You know, I'm just not doing it. You know, they are now a Dragon Rampant army, you know.
Right.
What's it called? Saga Age of Magic. That's another
I've been interested in.
Kind of resource based system, which is quite fun.
That looks really cool too. I'm really interested in playing that and giving it a go, actually. I think that might be a good game. But anyhow, look, we're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be back in just a moment to talk more about your history and how you got into wargaming.
If you are enjoying this podcast and the content on the Crown of Command Games YouTube channel, then please consider supporting me on Patreon. Becoming a Stormboy allows you access to behind-the-scenes news, information on upcoming podcast guests and themes, video battle reports, and occasionally exclusive podcasts with special guests or fellow patrons. And coming soon are painting videos, which we made to give you the skills and tips on painting in the Red Period using modern paints and practical applications. And you can also access one-to-one painting lessons in the Heavy Lead Masterclass tier for a 40-minute personalized painting lesson. So check out patreon.com/thecrownofcommandpodcast.
Okay, so thanks and welcome back after that short little promo. And we were talking about various different things with Stompy about the miniature agnostic games that you're interested in and that kind of thing. And I think they're taking more prevalence in the smaller companies out there making rule sets for those. Because, you know, to endeavor upon making an actual miniature range is quite an expensive outlay for any small company. So just making rules to adapt to the miniature ranges you have seems like much more of a better proposition to most people out there, I think, in smaller companies.
And I think, is it Osprey Games? You know, their whole business model has been fantastic. They're almost like, it's kind of like, you know, seed investment capitalists, you know, where they'll have a portfolio of like, you know, 20, 100 startups, understanding that like 95 of them are going to fail, but one of them is going to be like, you know, Google or Amazon or whatever. And they do well out of it. I mean, Osprey's hit rate, I would say, to be fair, is a lot better than that. But, you know, to be cruel but fair, you know, one or two are great concepts, but, you know, they could have done with a bit more playtesting and they don't kind of have legs. Albeit some of them, I don't know why they die. I mean, there's Dracula's America, for example, which is basically a miniatures agnostic kind of cowboy game with, you know, unbelievable depth of lore for all manner of kind of esoteric, fantastical elements. And, you know, it didn't seem to do well. The author felt a bit bad. He sort of posted and said, you know, they've said, you know, it hasn't sold like they hoped. And, you know, so there's not going to be any kind of follow-ups. But I've played it loads in my local gaming store, and it kind of unlocks you playing with obviously all the amazing War Games Foundry cowboys, you know, all, you know, I think Black Scorpion Miniatures cowboys, and then a lot of the North Star kind of weird and wonderful 19th century creatures from Gothic lore.
Right. Yeah, there's so many good things. Like I recently came across a game called Lucid Eye. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but basically it looks like a small British company, and they've got Rick Priestley to design the rules for it. And it's all basically like elves versus elves kind of thing. I think there's only one race.
Is it the Red Book of the Elf King? So Lucid Eye is the name of the company.
Yeah.
And again, I haven't played that game. But the miniatures are brilliant because it's
beautiful.
Saleh.
Yeah.
There's a number of sculptors, and they would definitely grab your eye because you and I think share an eye for a certain kind of miniature.
Yeah.
You know, so but in contradistinction, like, you know, people who go mad on 3D sculpting with ZBrush, and every micro detail is there, and the hands are the right size, and the weapons are very thin. You know, I'm not interested in that. You know, I like the kind of Nick Collier, Matt Bickley, Mark Copleston kind of concept of you just need enough detail on there to differentiate it from what it's not, so people can see what it is and people will enjoy painting it, and it's got kind of pronounced but not unusual or ridiculous kind of features. And that's my kind of miniature, and I think that's why Oldhammer retains its kind of grab for so many people. You know, in 50 years time, all that Oldhammer Trish Morrison stuff from the late 80s will still be amazing, Whereas how many people will have even the lovely Warhammer Underworlds plastic sculpts from Games Workshop and think that's brilliant?
Yeah. Now the when you said Matt Bickley, their new Viking range for Footsore is coming to Kickstarter soon, which looks absolutely incredible. I've never seen Viking models look so good. The way he's posed them, the way he's given them sort of like they're moving, or they give them some kind of dynamic pose. But yeah,
they as one piece metal sculpts.
Yes,
they've done that as one piece metal sculpts.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And I love one piece metal sculpts. After coming through the through the academy of putting Infinity miniatures together for many years, and is saying that's it, that's the last Infinity miniature I'll ever put together. Yeah, having those one piece miniatures is just so nice. It makes cleaning and assembly just a joy rather than an absolute labor. So they look amazing. So they're again, like I like On Tabletops with Jerry's Indie of the Week. I really enjoy that segment more than anything else because it's basically showcasing someone out there with an incredible range of miniatures that they make, and it's always something new that I've never discovered before. I was even looking at Foundry's website yesterday at their historicals for like Baron's War, because I was looking for some like peasants and that kind of thing to use as green troops, and they've got a wonderful range which is not that expensive, and they're all beautifully hand sculpted, designed by I believe the Perrys. They've even got like the old original Citadel Baron's War, which are really nice too. So
I think there was some case. I tried to find it for a laugh on one of the search engines. You know, there was some case which sort of said, that a consultant basically owns the intellectual property to what they've sculpted, unless there's some kind of contractual arrangement otherwise. And I think Games Workshop just couldn't put its hand on all the contracts with all those sculptors from the late 80s. And so War Games Foundry was like, great. We can, these are designed by the Perrys. Perrys have said we could use them. Right. And so you often see on eBay some very naughty people who I think must know better taking those kind of Baron's War figures from the late 80s and saying OOP. I'm like, mate, those are not OOP.
Yep, that's right. I saw on Nick's channel, Medieval Wargamer, he's doing the Baron's War sort of campaigns at the moment, and he's got one miniature that is from the War Games Foundry that he bought in the 90s when he was studying at university there. And that miniature, for me, just stands out from all the other stuff because it looks so cool. It looks so old Hammer. It looks like something out of, like, the third edition rule book for Warhammer Fantasy. It's so cool. I love it. There's something about that. There's something about those old miniatures and the style in which they were designed that just pulls me to them so much more than a lot of this modern, overly detailed, too extravagant type of miniatures. You know what I mean? I suppose it depends on the setting, but yeah, I think simple is better.
And it's not just a Games Workshop thing, of course. For example, today I between various things finished painting a Trollkin miniature from. What's it called? What's that game called? It's set like in a steampunk universe, and it was very big by Privateer Press for many years.
War Machine.
And suddenly just went quiet.
Hordes. Like Hordes.
War Machine and Hordes. I have these mind blanks, which is why I pre-record stuff, of course, rather than going live and brave like you. And this miniature is a beautiful miniature, and these Trollkin, they're basically like steampunk Tau. And this guy is holding this humongous, like, kill every mother stuffer in the room kind of like hand cannon. And even just flogged all my Trollkins years ago because I thought this game was going nowhere. And it was too fiddly in the first place, I thought, even though it was very popular. But I kept this miniature. And then I realized that there's effectively a similar kind of unit type in Manta Games Dead Zone. And I thought the moment has come for this miniature. He can enter the stage. He's going to be painted, and there'll be a game in the next few weeks, and it would be great. And I looked at it, and even though it was a beautiful one-piece miniature, there was just so much unnecessary detail. I don't know if the sculptor is big into kind of like leather and buckles and whatever. There were so many things that like someone like Nick Collier or Mark Copperson would have just said, "You don't need that. It doesn't add anything. It's going to irritate the person playing it. No one, instead of painting it, no one playing it is going to see it. You know, to give you an example, it's a great little detail, but this guy has big, huge hands. These Trollkin are like Tau with oversized hands,
yeah,
and slightly orcish comedy. And he's wearing, and he's holding this huge, massive mega cannon. Fine. Yeah. And he's wearing like gloves that, I forgot what they're called, gloves that don't like cover your fingertips. And I thought to myself, and it took me a long time to realize halfway through the paint job that his whole hand wasn't going to be blue. Half his hands was going to be blue. And then I was going to have to form some kind of executive decision on what color the gloves were going to be in circumstances where he's wearing a massive leather jacket full of buckles all over the place and silver. And I thought, why have they, this is a hobby, right? Why have they created an unnecessary problem for me? So, you know, I think unnecessary detail is just something that people should think about if they're sculpting.
Well, I say that, but I paint a lot of the confrontation miniatures from Rackham back in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, which I absolutely adore. And then they set the precedent for like overly detailed models, but I love them. You know, I enjoy that challenge of painting those models because they're so beautifully, exquisitely, you know, designed and made. So it depends. For me, it really depends because that is like each individual model is like a character model. It's not, we're not playing Warhammer where you have regiments of various different similar, you know, design models. This is like these three goblins are all differently posed. They're all got their own different identity. And, you know, that's wonderful. I think that's their charm in a small skirmish game like that. So it's, you know, it's whatever people desire. Some people thrive on detail. Some people like the simplicity of the older designs and you know, I suppose historical gaming, now that I've sort of looked at that a little bit more, I like the heraldry. And you can have a very simple-looking knight, but then with a particular paint job and his, you know, motifs or colours and that kind of thing can make a big difference on the tabletop.
The heraldry is I've always found very challenging.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to be an actual artist to be able to do that kind of thing. But the thing is, what becomes particularly complex is most of the places where the heraldry appears aren't flat. So you've now got to imagine what this like double-headed eagle is going to look like on some kind of fold of a cloak. And I'm like, mate, that's like a level of artistic, you know, intelligence that I just don't have.
That's
and
right.
And he does. You have it, but not everyone else does.
So, mate, look. Well, we're going to talk about how you got into miniature gaming. We've sort of done this back to front. So
that's all right. Listen, we're assuming people are still listening, or you know, they're sitting with their snacks, they're sitting there painting.
We hope so. We hope they.
I mean, what I would say is, you know, you've got to give people a sense on when you have chats like this that we aren't actually talking about the hobby. Because there's this balance between all these like really fun and funky kind of anecdotes, which have nothing to do with gaming, but give life to who we are and the prism through which we see gaming. But equally, you've got to talk about the hobby. So we've done well. So I collected some thoughts, but by all means, interject, because I recognize that, you know.
No, please. Go for it, mate. Just tell us, what was the catalyst? What got you into wargaming? Was it through your friends or fathers, or you know, was it through just going by a game store one day and picking something up?
We're talking like earliest childhood here. You know, they talk about the kind of collector gene, but I had the wargaming gene. So you know, when I was like, so I think my mum in particular had a massive interest in kind of like history.
Yeah.
And so she would see things and then just buy them for me. You know, thinking, oh, you know, vicariously, you know, my kid will have the interest I do. And it was an amazing gift she gave me. And so I grew up in South Africa. I don't know exactly what they were. They might have been Airfix, but Airfix obviously did 172. But I did a range of like 54 millimeter kind of like, you know, there were Egyptians, there were Romans. There were only like, I think, 12 in the pack, and they were huge. And, you know, a kid couldn't swallow them. So when I was like two or three, she might have bought them for me. And so I used to play with those. And then if you think about it, you know, all the movies that we watch as kids are gearing us up to be, you know, gearing you up to be a gamer. You know, so obviously there was like all the history stuff. There was a military history museum in Johannesburg with all the tanks and stuff that they basically captured in North Africa. And they had this amazing auditorium where they would play like, you know, the best like military movies of like, you know, the 60s and 70s, like the Guns of Navarone and Battle of Britain and, you know, all of that stuff. And I used to go watch it. And then obviously there was all the sci-fi stuff, you know, the cartoons and sci-fi stuff and fantasy stuff, which you might not think of as fantasy. But, you know, if you look at like Burrows and Badgers, you know, like animals set in a kind of medieval setting with weapons and a bit of politics thrown in. You know, I used to love watching The Secret of Nim. I watched it so many times. I don't know if you know that. If you ever saw that cartoon by Don Bluth, I think.
Right.
And, you know, it was all about these kind of like rats. You know, they're basically Skaven, you know, living in this farmhouse, like these small Skaven, having their own kind of like, you know, Game of Thrones little fights and stuff. And I loved that as a kid. And you had the Black Cauldron and the Sword and the Stone and Disney's Robin Hood and all that. And then in terms of sci-fi, you know, I'd watch the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And so for me, and it's continued to this day, and I hear other people talking about this, you know, the miniatures that you choose to play with or paint that week are the ones that you were inspired to do so by something you've seen in popular culture or a book you've read or a TV program you've seen. And so for me, from the earliest age, I would kind of reenact out the things I'd seen with the kind of these plastic miniatures I had. And I remember my mom also got me these, I think they're called Britons. They were very expensive, so we couldn't buy too many.
Yep.
But they were like these kind of like lead figures that were kind of painted. And I think she got me some Germans and Brits from World War II. And this quite big plastic German U-boat toy. And I remember there was, I was only six. And I was talking to this mate of mine, and he said, "This stuff is amazing." He goes, "Do you have any more of this?" And I said, no, I've got all of this stuff. You know, I've got like a little U-boat port, like from this particular movie. And I've got like loads of these Brits and loads of these Germans. And he looked at me and goes, you don't, do you? And I was like, no, I don't. But I wish I did. I imagine that I will one day. And then there was this like after school kind of club where there was this guy. He's passed now. His name was Les Netherton. And he used to write these books about model airplanes, but not plastic kind of Airfix airplanes, but the ones that you kind of construct out of wood, like, you know, stick an elastic band on, turn the propeller and kind of throw through a park. Yeah. And I went, you know, when I was like 10 years old, 10, 11, and it was very fiddly and I used to love it. It was with balsa wood. But the thing is, after a while, I thought to myself, you know, I'm spending ages making these planes. You know, you get out there, you know, you pull your elastic band, you watch this little plane soar through the sky, and then it smacks into a tree. And there's all these struts, and, you know, you've got to get this paper and, you know, this particular kind of glue. And, you know, it's basically the same as being like, you know, a ground engineer in the middle of the Battle of Britain. Like, why must I spend like the next 2 weeks fixing this thing up to smash it into a tree again? This is pointless, you know. And I thought, look, no one's going to care if I just rock up with some Airfix, you know, planes. And he was a lovely guy. He'd basically been in the war in South African Air Force in North Africa. And he used to always tell us stories. You know, if you're 11, this is fantastic. He used to say, like, oh, like once we captured this this German pilot, you know, we shot him down and we drove him back to the base. And, you know, he's sort of sitting there with his kind of like Iron Cross or whatever and standing there, you know, in his full kind of, you know, uniform, you know, and sticks out a seagull arm to show us, you know, you might have captured me, but we're going to win the war. And all of us South Africans are also sitting there, probably like Aussies, like, you know, wearing half of our own clothes, half of official uniform, you know, and swearing and saying, you know, we may just get on with it. Anyway, so he was like, and he liked me, and he was supportive of my various efforts. But he used to sort of say to me, like, he said, listen, kid, you know, you are an absolute grasshopper. You know, you just leap from one scale to another. And, you know, you need to focus. And I was like, why do I need to focus? Who cares that some of my miniatures are in 172 scale and some of my miniatures are in, you know, 156 scale? Who cares? These are just toys. And in many ways, that is the nature of my channel. You know, there's a lovely guy, I think, I don't know him at all. He's got a channel, it's called Scruffy Crow. And at the moment, he's diligently pursuing Warhammer and the Old World army. Using miniatures from, I think, the 90s and early 2000s, from the Beastman range. And he's been collecting these diligently. He's been basing them diligently. He's been painting them. And then he's going to play with them. And, you know, for me, actually, I've got like 10 or 20 different projects kind of steaming along at different speeds. And as time goes on, I kind of like top each one up. And I like to think they're all getting somewhere. But even if they don't get somewhere, I've got enough to be doing in each case. So I'm still that kind of grasshopper kid. And then over time, you know, I just thought to myself, I really want to have that kind of, I want to be able to play with the stuff. What's the point of just building it? But remember, I'm only 10 or 11.
Yeah.
And I used to go to like the WH Smith, you know, CNA it was called, with my parents, and they used to look at the papers and buy a magazine maybe. And I would go look at the War Games Illustrated magazine, which we could get. And War Games Illustrated would have, you know, miniatures by the Perrys, line drawings. There weren't too many photos in it because I think it was expensive to have color pages. So a lot of line drawings. But there would be loads of articles on kind of how to build buildings, how to build ships. And there was one article that was like, it just changed my hobby understanding. There was one bloke, you know, in some pretty suburb of England, which for me as a kid, you know, who knew where that was. And he obviously had a lot of, he had a tiled garden with grass, whatever. And he had like these flower beds. And what he did was he basically recreated like an imaginary 19th century Europe, like a kind of risk board with, you know, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Britain, Germany, in different parts of his garden. Out of concrete and plaster with like these little towns and cities, and he made like little ports, and then he built these like pocket battleships basically, and he had, and he painted these must be 50 some whatever the Britain scale is, you know, not, can't be 75, it must be 52 mil, something like that.
Yeah.
And he built little armies for them, and he did an article in War Games Illustrated about how he would basically do solo gaming in his garden, or, you know, battles on the high seas, you know, in the 1850s, 1890s, whatever it was, with the occasional kind of land battle. And I thought to myself, do you know what? We've got a table tennis table at home. I'm not a sporty guy. You know, I've played on this thing twice. I'll ask my parents if they don't mind me in the spare room opening up the table tennis table, because, you know, in South Africa, we had more space. In the UK, this would be unimaginable. I don't know what Oz is like, but, you know, in South Africa, there was, you know, we had space in homes more than people do in Northern Europe. And I thought, we've got all these like cupboard and stuff in this room. And what I'll do is I'll take my kind of like 1:72 scale little miniatures, you know, these tanks and these planes and all of that. I used to collect Eshi and Airfix figures, which are 1:72, 20 mil scale.
Mm.
And I've forgotten the name. It might be Usborne, but they used to produce these books with cardboard pages where you would cut out like a castle or a medieval village or a Viking village, and you would glue it together with kind of white glue. And I thought, great. So I've got like little towns and cities, and I would delineate like with string the borders of these different imaginary countries. And then I built like these little ships with like, it was very, very Games Workshop 1980s, you know, with like bits of like, you know, kitchen roll and cans and things. And I made some, you know, what I thought were quite impressive little battleships. You know, there's loads of food that comes in something, you know, something broad, the shape of a, you know, the outline of a battleship with straws for guns and things. And my mum was like, so said, this is great. She even played with me once. But the thing is, I had no understanding of rules because, you know, this is before the internet. You're not connected into what are the actual systems. It didn't occur to me that you could use dice for this. And so what I would do is I would take wooden clothes pegs and I would, I'd take one peg and I'd attach like the other pegs. So this thing was basically a bomb because they're not really that well attached. If you chuck this thing, it goes kaboom. And then basically I would just, you know, when countries declared war on each other, you know, I would just have these like little bombs and I would just sort of chuck it. And whoever basically had, whichever had the most figures fall down, they lost, you know. And this was great fun to do as a 10 or 11 year old.
Yeah.
And it was also, again, so I would reenact, you know, things I would watch on TV. And I would just, any 1:72 scale miniature I got would go to topping up the French, the Germans, the Brits. You know, and that was all good fun. And then what really kind of fueled this was what is, I suppose, a salutary lesson for us all. My mum saw an ad saying, you know, loads of gaming stuff for sale, you know, come over and we can talk. And we turn up to this posh suburb of Johannesburg, and there's this very kind of, you know, highfalutin lady, and she looks at us because we haven't got a great car, and she's like, you know, great, some kid and his mum. And so she takes us into this garage. So that her husband's dead, and she's trying to work out what to do with the stuff. She speaks very dismissively of all of this. I remember this very clearly, even though I was like 11. So we all have to think about what our partners really think of these garages full of miniatures that we have, you know. With it. Yeah. But anyway, so she was very diminishing about all of this. And she goes, basically, you can't look at any of that stuff over there. That's all painted. That's going to sell for good money. But over there is like this massive pile. And I mean, this guy must have collected like 30 years of 172 scale kind of buildings for model railways.
Wow.
And I didn't realize that at the time, but, you know, in like modern money, each of these little 172 scale buildings was like, you know, 20, 30 quid.
Wow.
And there were boxes and boxes of like Airfix stuff and Eshi stuff and tanks and Pegasus Bridge and all manner of things, and things which, frankly, I wish I'd kept, because I think these things have a value now. These things have all, they didn't survive a move to the UK. But anyway.
Yeah.
I said to my mum, how much can I spend? And she said, well, look, take 50 rand or whatever, you know, which is, I don't know, probably call it 50 quid in today's money. I think, great, I pick this and I pick that. And then she says, no, I've thought about it. You know, it's obvious that this is an amazing haul, you know, and we just won't spend more on this stuff for a while. Take 200 rand. And the lady looked at both of us and said, you're going to spend 200 rand on this stuff. And we were like, yep. And we just literally filled the boot, the back seat, you know. It was the most amazing.
That's
the
amazing, most amazing, isn't it?
I basically bought about another like four boxes of miniatures for the next 2 years.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So that's nice of your mother to do that for you too. That's lovely.
Oh, she was in my house today. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. She's always been vaguely interested in kind of art, not heavily, but it's the... But anyway, so I got out some Cyborg Miniatures terrain. He does absolutely beautiful, like faux Warhammer 40K.
Right.
What's it called? Grimdark kind of looking
stuff. Right. Okay.
And they're like kind of broken statues of, you know, Space Marines. Clearly.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful. And so I bought a few, but they don't require, you know, great artistic insight to paint. They've been spray painted gray. And I said, look, can you just take, you know, some of these dark washes, and then we'll just dry brush these and, you know, and I'll base them. And she had so much fun. She was, she did about half of them. And she's a savvy lady. She was like, you know, this army painter stuff, it doesn't quite flow as well as the Games Workshop one. I'm like, no. And she goes, I'm not really sure what value it's actually adding to kind of, you know, wash it with this dark tone. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. And so we just mix the dark tone and non oil together. And listen, it's terrain, you know, and yeah. I've always had a very relaxed attitude to the quality of terrain versus to miniatures. I don't know what your view is.
I was actually looking at my mighty fortress behind me, actually. I need to spray that up at some point and get that painted. It's one of those projects that I'm looking forward to doing. But yeah, terrain has been something, because I just talked to Mel, the terrain tutor, in the last podcast we did last week. And yeah,
he's
find
a genius.
Terrain,
I need to listen to that one.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, well, you only discovered about my podcast today.
I'm so embarrassed. I'm such a fan of all of your content.
That's good.
You've also got a range of products, and you know, you need to cross-platform it. You know, you need to sort of talk about, you know, each different element.
Yeah, I'll have to do that now. I didn't realize there were people out there who didn't even realize there was a podcast called The Krana Command. They just, because it's interesting. Anyway, but that's a different topic for a different day. But yeah, I think terrain has become something that during the time when we started playing games, we didn't have any terrain. And terrain was very much a secondary thing for us. And we plied our trade to try to find, you know, foam and what was then sort of mounting board
rolls,
picture frames and that kind of stuff. We would get that to make ruins for 40K second edition. And Epic already had all the terrain in the box, so that was easy.
Bamboo tubes.
And, yeah, all that kind of stuff. We had, like, And the fourth edition, fifth edition boxes had the, you know, the house and tower in it. So we just made like hills and, but nowadays, like now coming back into the hobby the last 4 years, yeah, getting back into making terrain was a really big thing for me. And I really wanted to replicate the images that other people like my good mate, Jeppe Denning from Denmark. He's an absolute genius, that guy. Not only like a fantastic painter, but he actually replicated all those buildings and terrain beautifully, like out of the White Dwarf magazines. So a bit of a shout out to him.
Tangents are the watchword of any podcast. So don't worry, we can get back to my story in a moment. But but basically, my grasshopper mind got drawn to the idea of, you know, playing with, are they 52 millimeter miniatures? There was that kind of, there was that Games Workshop game that came out maybe very late 90s, very early 2000s, where it was based on like a small number of miniatures in the grim dark world played at a much bigger scale.
Right.
I've forgotten the name of it because I've got a shocking memory. And I thought to myself, do you know what? I think this game is now free to download, or there's like a fan version. And I thought, you know, with 3D printing, you no longer need to pay like 50 quid for, you know, an OOP eBay miniature in this scale for this short-lived game.
Yeah.
You can just get it printed up. You know, I don't have a printer. We can talk about 3D printing. But, you know, you can pay someone to print one of these things up. You can buy the STL, pay someone to print it up for like £4 for this beautiful, huge miniature. And there's this one sculptor who I think does sculpt for Games Workshop, but he's got a Patreon, and he's clearly doing, you know, miniatures which are from the world of, what's it called, the kind of the Spire world, with all the gangs, the
Necromunda.
Necromunda, right. And if you remember rightly, there were these kind of like brat gangs, these kind of like rich kids who wear this kind of almost Eldar-like, Harlequin-like kind of, you know, sashed kind of kit. Mm. And he's done some amazing miniatures for that. And I thought, well, you know, you could just get those printed out at the relevant scale, but not that much, and you could play. But then I thought, crikey, terrain, you know, am I really going to design, you know, even if it's a 4x4, am I going to design a 4x4 of the Underhive at, you know, 52 millimeter scale? And the answer is no. So, yeah. You know, terrain is not the mind killer as such, but it is the concept killer.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I think, you know, terrain plays a massive part in games now, especially now where you've got like a lot of skirmish games. So the terrain is really important for that kind of thing. For mass battle type stuff like Warhammer, it becomes, yeah, essential, but you don't need that much of it. You know, but it obviously gives you some strategic elements to the table, and of course some aesthetically pleasing looking things like contours, like hills, and that kind of thing. So it's not just necessarily all flat. But things like Mordheim and Necromunda and a lot of other games now, yeah, involves, you know, pretty terrain heavy boards. So, but I think companies are doing pretty good with like cardstocks buildings and that kind of thing nowadays. I even play with like.
I'm too snooty for cardstock buildings. That is too nice. I think some things are best left in the 90s.
Yeah. Cardstock buildings. Well, some of the things that like we played like just using 2D terrain, like a 2D forest, a 2D tree or whatever, you know, and that works really well too. And sometimes it looks kind of like you're looking like in a top down RTS video game, where you're moving the miniatures in this sort of scenic area on the board that's clearly marked out using this 2D piece of either mouse mat or cardboard, but it's doing the same thing. It's kind of aesthetically pleasing in that it's all nicely colored and, you know, digitally created for you.
This man's opinion is that if you've reached that level of abstraction, you need to go and be a role player. You know,
yeah,
I've never had any time for role playing because, you know, I know so many people who love it. And, you know, you can be so creative and you can immerse yourself in the world. And I'm like, look, I want to roll the dice and have one miniature that looks like something, shoot another miniature that looks like something in a building that looks like something. So we all have our lines.
Yeah, I think there's some good innovations out there. That's what I'm trying to say. There's some good innovations to get what you want to do on your tabletop looking pretty, you know what I mean, without an extensive amount of knowledge or things like that. But yeah, Mel the terrain tutor, as we alluded to before, you know, he's doing it the old school way, and I really respect that, because there's a lot to learn. It's a hobby, like you say, in itself, like painting or just gaming or, you know, medalist creating or whatever it might be. There's something really nice and satisfying about making your own terrain, as I've discovered again, you know, making my own.
There very much is. And I think particularly, you know, with Mordheim and Oldhammer, if you made, you know, one of those kind of concoctions out of balsa wood, you know, and a little bit of kind of, you know, I don't know what it's called, polyfiller, you know, and cut out kind of, you know, cereal packet kind of cardboard slate tile roofs and painted it, you know, with all those kind of weird kind of, you know, little bridges and houses connected over other houses, you know, there is something absolutely fantastic about that. And in my friendly local gaming store, one guy actually combined doing a bit of that himself with some of the MDF stuff you can get, you know, for that kind of type of housing. And it's absolutely fantastic. But then unfortunately, he's more of a grasshopper than me. He's totally abandoned this Mordheim campaign, which I also painted some night goblins for, Oldhammer night goblins. But you know what? You've reminded me, I will bug him, because the visual spectacular of what he's done is in and of itself, you know, a hobby delight.
Yep, absolutely, man. Yeah, nice. That's wonderful.
Right. So, go on.
Okay, so what we might do, we might have to go to another ad break just quickly. And when we come back, we might give you a bit of a quiz, mate, from Jervis Johnson himself. So so stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Have you always dreamed of having your old Games Workshop armies professionally painted in the style of the White Dwarf battle reports of the 1990s? Well, let me introduce you to Evi Lead Painting Studios Japan. As a professional painter with over 30 years' experience and having a short stint working at the Games Workshop Nottingham studio as a miniature painter in the mid-1990s, I now work as a full-time professional miniature painter, having the joy to turn your old love metal and plastic miniatures into life with saturated colour and, of course, with goblin green bases. For inquiries, please contact me via email at evyled@gmail.com. That's EAVYLEAD@gmail.com. And please check out the links in the show description for my Facebook gallery page. And I hope to hear from you soon to start your dream project. But so Stompy, and you wanted to finish your story, mate. So please continue before our quiz.
So that's the end of me kind of being sort of, you know, 13, that period's over. And then I go to the UK and, you know, I turn up at, you know, I see that there's Games Workshop, you know, I walk past the stores, you know, I go to, I think it's called Reveil in Bristol. You know, it was one of these wargaming shows, and I see, I think they're called Front Rank Miniatures. And, you know, we've all seen Last of the Mohicans, and instead of having these like tiny, impossible to paint little 172 miniatures, you've got 28 mil metal miniatures with like kind of character. And, you know, we discussed it at length before, that kind of amazing, you know, approach to miniatures, you know, because actually, strangely, even those like 1980s 172 Eshi plastics were massively detailed, which, you know, a 10 and 11 year old could not paint with enamel paints. You know, I caused mass damage to my bedroom with enamel paints. And for the sake of entertainment, you know, I was reading about how some studies come out saying that, you know, a lot of people with Alzheimer's, it's arisen because they pick their nose, because, you know, it releases weird toxins and it causes, you know, over a long period causes brain damage. And I thought to myself, oh dear, because if that's the case just from picking your nose, you know, having thinners all over the place at the age of 10 and 11 with enamel paints is, you know, in 10 years, I'm sure I just won't be talking. But anyway, and I saw that there was this whole world out there and that there were games with dice. And it was obviously much better than just chucking, you know, peg bombs at these miniatures. But the thing is, these things were very expensive, very, very, very expensive. And so I couldn't really buy too much of it. I'd gone to this British school where, you know, sport was a big thing. And so they would take like, there would be like seven teams. So even the biggest Malco, the person with like no coordination, like myself, could still be in a team and stuck on a bus all of Saturday afternoon, halfway across the country to play rugby or cricket or whatever. And so I would find increasingly kind of cunning ways of not being taken into even the worst team. You know, I'm from South Africa. You know, even the biggest Malco there is just forced to play rugby. So I knew how to play rugby. And I remember in this one try, I thought to myself, what is the dumbest thing I can do just to not get taken into this team? And I just grabbed the ball. It came to me. And instead of like, you know, clutching it with two hands and throwing it and spinning it like we'd kind of trained to in South Africa, I just took this thing and just went, just threw it over my head and just threw it like, forward. And I remember this British teacher just put his hand over his face and was like, right, okay, well, you're not going to, name of school, next week. And I was like, perfect. So that meant I had like every Saturday afternoon, for like the next 5 years free.
Right.
And yeah. I couldn't afford to get into, all the Oldhammer games. And so that's why I have no second, third, fourth, fifth edition Warhammer. But all those niche games, like particularly Blood Bowl, well, that's something any kid could afford. And so I used to play Blood Bowl, and in the afternoons, and other guys would be very happy to play it. And they were just the kind of miniature that we've discussed. And then I went to university, and again, I still never had the money for it. So I played a bit of Necromunda. I remember there was one guy from America. He was like literally 7 foot tall, and he was into Warhammer. It must have been some kind of growth issue, but he was obviously a genius, and he loved this stuff, and he was very characterful. He actually wanted to play role playing, but as I've described, my mind isn't in a place, for that kind of level of abstraction.
Yeah.
And so we played, I had Gorka Morka figures. Oh yeah, Gorka Morka, loved that.
Right.
So I played that at university, and then I got a proper job, I moved to London, and I would go to the Games Workshop store, and this was around 7th edition, and the miniatures were fantastic, and I had Orcs and Goblins, I had Empire, I dipped my foot into Chaos. But basically, I never played a game I enjoyed. I would rock up with this heavy miniatures case. I never had a car. I would lay out all the figures. And once in a blue moon, I had a slightly weird Orc and Goblin army. My favorite piece, because everyone dismissed Orcs and Goblins as like a real force. And I had one Savage Orc boss on a boar chariot. And no one realized that he was frenzied. And the whole board chariot was frenzied. So if this thing hit you, it was like 30 dice or something.
Yeah, classic.
But that was my only trick. I was a one-trick pony.
Right.
And every other kid who turned up, because I was a bit older then, I was a young professional. And most people there were like, kids or teenagers. Because I didn't really know where can you meet people to play this. And they would rock up with like dark elves, which would just shoot me to death. Or demons who didn't seem to do anything in any of the phases. They had no morale, all they did was just kill you. So there was no fun in that. Well, undead, where you killed them and then they all just came back.
Yeah.
And so I never enjoyed a single game, just to tie it into our discussion about the growth of, creative individuals who, through Osprey, are coming up with these, rules of Gnostic systems, which are actually good, or Mantic, which do fantastic systems like Kings of War and Dead Zone. Every time I play Dead Zone, it's a great game. If I lose, it's still a great game.
Yeah.
I never enjoyed a game of Warhammer 7th.
Right. Interesting.
And then, obviously, I'm not you. My painting isn't fantastic.
It's not bad.
And a guy used to come around to my house to play Malifaux, actually. His name was Tom Greenway. And he would say, Stompy, for... for someone with no artistic background, you're the best painter I've seen. I said that's a big compliment, because you do have an artistic background, and it's a backhanded compliment. But I took it in the spirit it was intended. And where is Tom now? Tom has obviously started Moonstone Miniatures, which is a fantastic game, and I need to add to my collection. So that's on my to-do list. He left London and went out west here in the UK, and he has a marketing background, and He has a background in medieval martial arts as well. So he paid a lot of money for this amazing suit of armor, and then would kind of go and bash people up at the weekends. And he loved Malifaux, which is obviously a card-based game. And so I think he kind of mashed the best of all of that you know, all the moves he understood, because he understands combat. You know, I roll the dice and imagine someone thumping someone. He understands that, you know, knights didn't go clunk, clunk, clunk. They were just as skilled as samurai. You know, that's what they were trained to do. That's how they did it.
Mm.
Anyway, so I started thinking, look, this is not a great game. There must be other games out there. And so I dabbled in Malifaux, which was a fantastic game with cards, and there was much less, it was more to do with resource management than managing risk,
mm-hmm.
which I enjoyed. The downside of Malifaux was it took like, you know, 7 hours or 5 hours to play a game. You know, I don't regard myself as particularly thick. I haven't got the kind of mind that can kind of churn, numerical risk in my mind as I go. You know, I just have a go depending on how I see it.
Yeah.
So I played a bit of that. I played a lot of Blood Bowl in a center specialized just in Blood Bowl, ECBBL. Right. Give it a massive shout out. Lovely people. But mostly I got my butt handed to me every single week. They would have leagues, and these were talented people who just played this game. And so I would say, okay, fine, look, I'm not going to be in your leagues because, you know, because my job, I can't guarantee rocking up anyway. So I'll just turn up and play pickup games, and got my butt handed to me in the pickup games. But anyway, but that was good fun. The problem was that at the end of each of these games, you know, I had to keep moving further and further out of London because of, you know, housing prices and, you know, as you grow up and have a family. And I would find myself stuck in central London at like 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night with like a 2 hour journey. And I was like, okay, this is not viable. And then I discovered that there was a, you know, a friendly local gaming store very close here.
Right.
And they were delighted to get me. You know, you want a grasshopper guy who just got the collection gene in your friendly local gaming store.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
And they are absolutely lovely. They have a number of kind of work streams. They've got, you know, people who are the local community. They've got an online store, and they go around the country and to every kind of war game show and just, you know, represent other people. And that's the Pit Gaming Shop. And that kind of totally opened up the world that you and I have just been discussing, because I've now got, you know, loads of War Machine figures, loads of Malifaux figures, loads of Oldhammer figures, Games Workshop figures, and there are now people there who will basically play pretty much anything with me, and that's where I am today. And so a lot of what I kind of put out of the garage, what I painted on my channel, is reflective of what I'm about to play with these people in the store.
Yeah.
And that is my tale.
Wow, that's wonderful, mate. What a colorful story that is too. You've been everywhere, from South Africa to London, and collecting various different things from railway houses to Orc and Goblins, mate. So it's quite an extensive history. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, I do enjoy my job. I love my family.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think you do have to do something for yourself. And I was reading a book called, which is going to be on my channel at some point in the next couple of weeks. It's a book from 1986 called Miniature Heroes for War Games or something. And it's a Games Workshop book.
Yeah, I love that book. I gave it away before I left to Japan. It's my biggest regret.
Like this book,
yeah,
but I'm going to read it, put it on the channel, and I'm sure we can work something out.
Okay.
You know, welcome to have it. It's just I'm not sure what to do about the 20 quid postage to Japan. But anyway, we'll work that one out. So, and they I forgot why I mentioned it. That's it. They said, you know, it starts off in the introduction saying, you know, because I think, I don't know who wrote it, but there are a lot of deep thinkers in this hobby. And the guy who wrote this book says, you know, in society, we've all become highly specialized, you know, in a kind of post-industrial world in our jobs. What we do is so specific, which means that what we're doing every day is so specific. And he goes, and if you want a bit of creativity in your life, you know, this hobby lets you collect, trade, assemble stuff, kit bash stuff in creative ways, paint stuff in creative ways. And so, you know, we discussed what I do. I'm not going to disclose what it is, but, you know, it's not artistic in the slightest.
Yeah.
And this has allowed me to do something which, you know, can can tick a certain box and add a small spark to your life that actually enriches, you know, your work and your life with your family, because you can get the kids involved in all this. I've done that.
Yeah.
And actually, if I think about my work, fundamentally what I'm doing is I'm still making Airfix kits. People come to me to, you know, create conceptually something which, you know, is basically just a complicated kit that I've kit-bashed.
Right. Okay, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, that's good, mate.
Your quiz. I've already shown my flaws, which is my appalling memory. So you're welcome to ask me any question you want. But well, I'm the worst guy to have in a pub quiz.
I'm gonna give you a choice. You've got Gav Thorpe, you've got Andy Jones, Jake. What's Jake's last name again? Jake Thornton, that's it, and Jervis Johnson. So you've got those to choose from. Which one would you like? Which quiz from which person? Any favorites?
Again? Gav Thorpe,
Andy Jones, Jake Thornton, and Jervis Johnson.
Oh, Jervis Johnson.
Okay, so this is Jervis's favorite pub quiz questions. So Jervis has put together the pub quizzes held at the tournaments we ran last year. Here are five of my favorite questions. Watch out, because they're not all about Games Workshop stuff. So number one, when did Games Workshop become a public limited company?
This is the point at which they turn to the side of evil. That's very rude. You would say it opens up to wider public scrutiny. I have no idea, but my guess would be it could be quite late. 2005.
It's actually October 1994.
You're kidding.
No. Yeah, because when I worked for Games Workshop, and that was, I think, 94 when I first joined. Yeah, Tom Kirby had already started running that company. Yeah, and Brian Ansell had already left. I think he left about 92. I think Brian Ansell left in 92, 93. So obviously then the Tom Kirby era started in 1994. So there
you go. Good for them. Say what you want about them, and people do naughtily kick them. But they are the pumping heart of the hobby. If they went, I'm not sure that all these, you know, one-man bands would sustain it.
That's right. Yeah, because, you know, all the guests I have on the show, they all have their sort of lineage in gaming through either being a red shirt for Games Workshop or having discovered Games Workshop through their local gaming store or whatever it might be. So everyone's come through the GW induction, mate, basically. Okay, so two. Who absolutely will not stop? Might be your Savage Orc big boss.
Listen, I'm not big on the law, to be honest. I mean, it sounds like Gotrek.
It says
they just keep going until they get killed. I don't know.
It says the Terminator. I don't really get that one. But who will not stop? And maybe that's like a reference to the Terminator movie. I think that's what it means. It's the Terminator movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I was nothing to do with Games Workshop.
No, because he says be careful, because they're not all about Games Workshop stuff. I think that's what that was referring to.
I would question the lawfulness and validity of the question.
Three.
Because, you know, at no point does the Terminator say, you know, he will not stop, I will not stop, I'm sure. But anyway, move on to the next one.
Now, number three, the question three is someone actually we talked about recently with Tom and some guys in Discord as one of my favorite painters. So who is the only person to win the Golden Demon Slayer Sword more than once? Now this is in 1996 when this is published. So at this stage, at 1996, who is the only person to win Golden Demon Slayer more than once?
I have no idea, but I've got all the books. I could go and research it. So just share. Go on.
This is a name from the past. Paul Robbins.
Never have got that.
Okay. Well, he was famous. We were just talking about it before, actually. And I'm actually repainting my Slayers, my Dwarf Slayers, because I absolutely love those miniatures. And Paul did a beautiful diorama, I think in 1992, Golden Demon 92. He made this beautiful, not a diorama, it's basically just regiments of dwarf, marauder dwarves on this scenic display base. And it was absolutely gorgeous. It's my favorite Golden Demon Slayer and winning entry of all time. So four, In which hand does Jane Tsar hold the Silent Death?
I don't even know who Jane Tsar is.
Jane Tsar is one of the Phoenix Lords of the Banshees, the Howling Banshee, Phoenix Lord for the Elder in Warhammer 40K.
Okay. I don't know. Her right hand. It's a 50-50 question, isn't it?
It's actually the left hand. In the right hand, she carries a Blade of Destruction, which would have been an extra point. But don't worry, mate. You might get the next one. The last one. Number five. What are the last words of the talking bomb in the film Dark Star? I've absolutely no idea. So what are the last words of the talking bomb in the film Dark Star?
All right. So look, everyone in our hobby is a sci-fi and fantasy geek who has seen many films in the genre, but I've never even heard of the Dark Star.
Me either. I've never heard of Dark Star either. So let there be light is what he's the last words the talking bomb said. So there you go.
I mean, that's very funny because that, you know, Genesis, you know, God says, you know,
let there be light
in the creation of the world. And this thing is making a gag in very dark humor because it's about to like eviscerate everyone in the room with the story of Genesis and creation. So that's cute.
Now, of course, if the one thing I love about the new sort of live streams that I'm doing on YouTube is basically the same thing, but we have the interactions of the audience. Podcasting can be a very kind of unknown place because you don't have any feedback. There's no sort of response, automatic response. Now, we could have had a live audience feeding us information about this movie or giving you hints or answers to some of those questions to help you out. You could have had the, like they say in sports, the 11th man helping you out there, mate, during those questions. But alas.
You know what? Maybe another time.
Yeah.
The only thing is that, you know, YouTube is obviously a very visual medium. And because, you know, I don't really want the world to know that I'm deeply passionate about Kev Adams' dwarves in terms of my just credibility generally. It's not something we can do. I mean, I'm reminded of when, you know, I went to this Blood Bowl club and this guy from work, you know, happened to bump into me. And he said, you know, hey, you know, I live around the corner. What are you doing here? And I said, and I lied. I said, I'm just going to go have some drinks with some mates. And he kind of paused, looking at me, you know, waiting to be invited. And I said, and I kind of just half broke down. I'm joking. You know, I said, look, I said, you can't tell anyone. I'm going to tell you because, you know, I don't want you to be offended that I haven't invited you around for drinks. I'm going to go into the first floor of a pub and I'm going to play a board game, but, you know, which is based on American football and fantasy figures and dice. And we're going to do that for a few hours and, you know, have a drink and a curry. And then we're all going to go our separate ways. And you can't tell anyone at work I do this. And he looked at me and he laughed. He was a very good natured Canadian. And he was just like, don't worry. He goes, your secret is safe with me. I'm glad that you're doing something which isn't just working till midnight, which is, you know, the joys of our job. So, you know, when I retire.
Yes, absolutely. Now, look, so Stompy, look, I really appreciate all this time. It's probably one of the longest podcasts we've ever had. So, thank you so much for giving us so many great insights and telling all these wonderful stories about, you know, the history of where you've come from and how you got into the hobby and how the channel has evolved into something, like you say, it's something, a distraction. It's an escape from the ordinary or the stress of the life and the work you lead. And it's a nice little thing that you can do for yourself and share it with people like myself that enjoy the content that you make. So I'm really looking forward to the Heroes in Wargaming book review that you're going to do soon. I love that book. So that's really true old hammer in all its glory.
Thank you for having me on. You are a gift to the community, you know, because you know all about Workshop. You're a fantastic painter. Your stuff is educational. It shows us behind the scenes, in front of the scenes, and inspires us. And you're bringing people together, you know, and that's what the hobby is really about. So keep at it.
Snobby, thank you so much, mate. That's very nice. That's lovely for you to say. And I hope that, I can bring, a more awareness to people like yourself, your channels, and the people that I like watching and listening to. And
like the bomb, you can, create light.
That's right. So, and then getting to meet you and saying, you know, actually talking to you, which is the best part. So I really appreciate it, mate. So don't stop what you're doing. I think you're doing a really fantastic job out there with Stompy51 YouTube channel. So the links will be down in the show notes of the podcast. Please go down there because the affiliated links with Rosemary & Co. and Stompy's channel links will be there, plus anything else related to the podcast will be there, including the YouTube channel. So you can go and check out those live streams we'll be talking about during today's interview. So with that, mate, look, go to bed. It's late. My day is just about to start. I live in your future, my friend. So take care, and we'll hope to see you and speak to you again sometime in the future, Stompy.
You will. Keep well, keep safe.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.